May was Sydney's best loved month. After an overture of daffodils and tulips, the summer orchestra tuned to the sound of blackbirds, wood pigeons, and returning swifts. Each day outpaced its predecessor with new provision, an acceleration of green, a stretching of light. Now aged 7 and a half, Anna was just finishing her first year of junior school, and she was in the middle of a wildflower project inspired by W. Keble Martin's Concise British Flora in Color. 2 years before, she had written to the author for advice, and the 90-year-old priest had replied on a postcard to say that the natural world offered endless discovery, infinite possibilities. If she learned to appreciate the landscape around her, then she would never be bored or lonely. Curiosity would keep her young. And so it was that father and daughter were out walking through 9-acre wood by the River Ouse with Byron, their beloved Labrador, beside them. They ambled past the oak and ash trees, tall by a stream edged with swatches of ramsons and marsh marigolds, and then went on through high cow parsley and flowering crabapple until they reached a sunlit clearing filled with early wood violets. This was a time for simple pleasures, a father, a lively young daughter, and their dog out together in the countryside. They stopped to rest, taking in the next vista and removing the sticky willy that had attached itself to their legs. They laughed when Byron attempted to chase a squirrel up a tree. He was so busy looking up that he ran straight into the trunk. It was only when they were checking and consoling him that they noticed a strange shape under a group of silver birch ahead. By the stream, and next to a clump of monkshood and a swath of bluebells that had yet come into full flower, was the body of a man. He was not lying in the comfortable arrangement of someone asleep or at rest, but the skewed position of a man who had either suffered a heart attack or been felled by an assailant. He lay on his front, the bulk of his face hidden by the Australian bush hat, and he was wearing a well-worn anorak, jeans, and hiking boots. A long gray ponytail, tied with an elastic band, stretched across his right shoulder and by his gloved hands. Gloves, Sydney thought, in May. And there lay a basket of wildflowers. Is he dead, Daddy? He might be sleeping. I think he's dead. Stay back, darling. I want to see him. Sydney knelt down and checked for signs of life. There were none. That's from the opening of the Grantchester Mysteries, Sydney Chambers and the Persistence of Love. It's a popular mystery series on many PBS stations, and it's the latest in the Prince series, featuring part-time sleuth, full-time priest, Sydney Chambers. Well, today's installment offers a series of stories told through a multiplicity of chapters, all of which feature the gentle, persistent detective probing as Sydney goes about his work as a parish priest in and around the small town of Grantchester, England, near Cambridge. The time may vary from ours. Sydney's world in this collection takes us back to 1970s in Great Britain. But Sydney's curiosity and friendship with a local town detective and the odd dearth of small-town tranquility make for mystery tales that entertain, make us think, and often delight. Characters in a Grantchester mystery starring Sydney Chambers, if you've not yet met them in print or on the screen, are somewhat surprising. Sydney Chambers, as I mentioned, is an Episcopal parish priest, now archdeacon, as our stories begin. His ecclesiastical territory takes in a number of small towns and their surrounding countryside, typically English, with riverine hills and valleys, and now includes his work with the church in the all but ancient English city of Cambridge. Well, this being a mystery series, we need to involve the local police as well. And one of Sydney's best friends, we learn, is a local detective with the police force. We expand our purview and take in Sydney's family, his wife Hildegard, young daughter Anna, whom we just met, and his beloved family dog, who leads Sydney and Anna to that unsavory find at the opening of our book in our review today, and together have the makings of a peculiar but appealing cast of regular characters. Today's lead story takes us into that aforementioned riverside countryside, where murder is afoot, and much too close to Sydney's family for his comfort. After all, he and his daughter nearly stumble upon the dead body as they're out collecting wildflowers for the daughter's end-of-term school project. Well, just as we wrap up that tale of jealousy and deceit, and we do, we're plunged into a new tale, which features one of Sydney's best friends, Amanda, whose professional work as an art dealer finds her stretching the definition of a painting she is convinced is from the Spanish master Goya. Her interpretation of the unsigned work goes a bit too far for other artwork aficionados, and Amanda gets the short end of the stick when she bids too enthusiastically at a manor house auction for an unauthenticated painting that she learns to her chagrin is not valued by the larger art world as much as it is by her. Sydney, an old friend and once could be lover, offers solace in his own Church of England way, and she, the chagrined friend, responds in kind. Here's just a moment of that interchange between the two. "Everything's gone," Amanda said. "I don't know how much is left of me. I don't know anything at all anymore. I wish you'd stop me getting into all of this." "I've never been able to prevent you from doing anything, Amanda." "But you know me best. Now I'm ruined." Sydney did not like to point out that Amanda could not be ruined if she was still able to fall back on her parents and she had only been suspended from her job at the British Museum. He was sure that her boss liked her enough to restore her position once she had acknowledged both that the fellow who had led her astray and that lessons had been learned. Amanda still had her beauty, her charm, and her connections. She was hardly likely to starve. He remembered Ted the Verger's point that there was a difference between being broke and being poor, and he had always rather despised people from rich families when they told him they had no money. Amanda had been chastened by an experience that was fueled in part by greed, just as he too had been humbled recently by meetings with Miss Morgan and Mrs. McGuire. Still, it didn't take much to throw a life off balance. We just had to hold on tight to what made the best of us, he decided. Perhaps he would preach about that next Sunday. The illusion, or at least the confining limitations, of the self. The next multi-chaptered mystery takes us into territory most mystery novels steer mightily away from confronting, taking us deep into the story of a good friend of Sydney's and her family, as they are torn asunder by the accusation of rape, a terribly fraught position for Sydney, as he tries with priestly evenness to determine the truth in the accusation, and at the same time, and as best he can, be supportive of the married couple whose marriage is threatened with disillusion as a result of the charge. It is perhaps not surprising that this particular story is held to later in the book's progression. The implications and the moral quandaries it proposes are not something most readers would want to plunge into in chapter one of any novel. But as a plot that comes a bit later in the book, we're more likely to tackle it once we've come to know Sydney and his environs a bit better. Well, more tales of mystery and ethical quandary follow, and our book ends with a personally moving tragedy, one that forces Sydney to examine his faith in God and in himself. As a reviewer wrote so well in the online review forum Goodreads, quote, "But most importantly, in the final story of the collection, the titular The Persistence of Love, we mark a return to the usual Sydney Chambers fare of yore. Perceptive, honest, thoughtful, and guaranteed to remain with the reader for a long time. If nothing else, the book is well worth your while for this novella alone, worth an extra star all by itself." End quote. Endearingly, each story told within these covers offers glimpses into Sydney's marriage and family life, glimpses that show us a couple and a family whose life together is built on love, most certainly, but on a deep and abiding friendship and understanding of each other as well. As his wife Hildegard puts it, when Sydney finally, nearly a month late, offers his wife their wedding anniversary gift. "This is very beautiful, mein Lieber. Will it tarnish?" As soon as she had spoken, Hildegard held up her hand to prevent interruption. "Don't draw any moral conclusions from the question. Just answer it. We will need to keep it in good repair, like our marriage?" "Yes, I know, Sydney. But I fear I'm getting too old for mirrors. I do not like to look at myself too much. I do not want to turn into my mother." "There's little chance of that, I promise," Sydney replied. "There's every chance," said Hildegard, "but I like to make an effort." She gave her husband a spontaneous hug, and they held onto each other in front of the cooker as the potatoes bubbled away. "I hope you are still proud of me, Sydney. I know I can be difficult. We can all be difficult." Hildegard stepped back. "You were not supposed to agree with me. You have to say that I am the easiest and most tolerant person in the world." "I don't know what I'd do without you, my darling." "Fortunately, you do not have to think about that." "Shall I put the mirror up?" Sydney inquired. "As long as you don't bang your thumb." "I think I can hammer in a nail." Hildegard smiled. "What is the 11th anniversary material?" "Steel, I think." "That is good. I think there is something called mild steel." "That describes you perfectly, Sydney. Tough when you want to be, but responsive to pressure." Sydney hesitated. "I don't suppose I could be stainless." "No, mein Lieber," said Hildegard. "That is my job." Well, Sydney, indeed, is a quirky enough character to stand on his own, with enough personality to surprise us, yet offer that priestly consistency that so many seek. When confronted by a fellow Episcopalian whose goal is to become one of the first Church of England women priests, we're deep into the 1970s at the time, let's remember, Sydney's verbal response is just what we'd expect from a clergyman of that period. Yet this is a parish priest who enjoys his pint with his friend and Detective Gordy Keating at the Prince Albert pub as they talk over matters of mystery and crime, who takes his dog for walks in the countryside and delights in the antics of his young daughter, Anna. Sydney is just enough like you and me, and he becomes a character we can welcome into our lives, despite his worrying dips into the world of evil doings, his penchant for not leaving well enough alone when a friend or an acquaintance needs his help to right a wrong, be it minor or life-shattering. And of course, there is Sydney's relationship with God, a relationship that Sydney turns to when bidden, and from which he takes both solace and seeks guidance as he struggles, as we all do, to make sense of the mysteries and the tragedies that come his way in this collection of stories. I'd like to finish this review not with the concluding chapter, as important and as moving as that one is, but with a moment midway through, as Sydney is chatting with his friend, the local police detective, Gordy, at the Prince Albert pub over their warm beers. They've just discussed the implications of God's actions in their lives and the need to respond to life with either optimism or dour acceptance. It's a great way to end this review, and it's why I hope to adventure more with Sydney, with his family, his friends, far into the future, as we join the two in their discussion at the end of yet another day. Sydney picked up his pint. "You know, whatever happens with Kathy or anything else, I will always be your friend." "You'd bloody better well be. You know I'd be lost without you," Gordy replied. The two men resumed their drinking. For a short while, they sat in companionable silence that neither had any desire to interrupt. Gordy unpacked a box of backgammon. There was a flicker in the sky, a trick of the light, perhaps, and the sun made a final appearance that day, low on the horizon, sending a brief beam across their garden table, a silver lining in the cloud. Sydney looked up and smiled at the warmth on their faces. "Don't," said Gordy, "don't even think about speaking." The Grantchester Mystery, Sydney Chambers and the Persistence of Love. It's now a major masterpiece PBS series. It's written by James Runcie and is available at all of our fine local libraries, including the West Lafayette Public Library.